Good morning. Wow. First of all, a really hearty thanks to that beautiful choir singing right behind me. It's quite joyous. And I also have to say, wow, standing up here. my goodness. If I was thinking if I don't get vertigo or get a nosebleed, we'll be doing all right. It's pretty amazing, but it's great to see your happy faces this morning and giving me the love. I have to say that I'm so appreciative and really grateful to be invited to share some simple reflections at First Unitarian Church this morning. I want to especially thank a few people that have been helpful in welcoming me, Neil, Bartholomew, very helpful Betty, of course, this morning as our associate, Fred with the music, who welcomed me, and also to Posey in the office here at First Unitarian. All very welcoming as we prepared. I'm well aware as I stand here, I guess I have to say this, because most of you are probably, maybe, more familiar with my better half, that is Kathy. It seems I am often known around Providence as Kathy Clasper Torch's husband. For those who don't know, Kathy is a professional musician, and she gets around more than I do, and has performed here at First Unitarian, as many of you know, with her group The Gnomes numerous times. So I have to also give a hearty thanks to Jim Esty and company for welcoming The Gnomes and us, and I have to say that probably the best Some of the best dancing I've done all my life has been here at First Unitarian to The Gnomes. We have many good friends here. It's a joy to be sharing in worship with you this morning. My own life journey and study really so resonates with the Unitarian philosophy and practice. While my primary spiritual discipline is not Unitarian, I'm ordained, and that practice is within the Christian Trinitarian Communion. My undergraduate and graduate studies, my passionate interests, and my spirituality has been fully informed by the world's wisdom traditions and paths, both East and West. Certainly one of the UU's hallmarks has been its expansiveness, the search for truth and meaning as the UU principles state, and your practice of the spiritual disciplines as they resound in the multifarious traditions of the world. My message is a simple one this morning, so I hope that you will find something in it that sparks your interest, your curiosity, maybe has you wondering, maybe gets you thinking, hopefully prods some questions. It may feel that it's resonant with you already, and just merely in some sense, mimicking and responding to what you already know and feel. For one reason or another, though, there might also be some little dissonance, and that would be good as well. I think there is a hunger in all of us, the universal need of all human beings, all conscientious seekers, to find words and wisdom to live by, to link our spirit with our actions, to bring our inner convictions into our outer engagements. Now, I don't know, but I would guess that all of you, like me, have those days where you really begin to wonder what it's all about. I don't know about you, but I wake up in the morning to the radio, to NPR, which may be my first mistake. What a way to wake up. Being tuned in and aware of the world's news and contemporary issues is critical, but to be confronted first thing in the morning by the reckless and the disturbing and unprecedented actions of our current administration, the terror of hunger and destitution, of violence in all of its gruesome and horrific forms, from war to mass murder in Las Vegas, racism in our streets, drone attacks in distant lands, torture at the hands of our own government, not to mention the planetary environmental degradation and eco-violence of human-induced climate change, where recent news headlines announced, I know that you're all familiar with, that this past year was measured as the hottest on record. And a climate scientist at Rutgers University was quoted as saying, "Any wisps of doubt that human activities are at fault are now gone with the wind." Heavy stuff to wake up to at 6 a.m. in the morning. In the face of so much grief, injustice, violence, and ecological upheaval in the world, we need to be able to find our center, to recollect ourselves, to renew our spirits, and commit ourselves to constructive and compassionate action in and for our world. But how do we do so? How do you and I not succumb to the cycle of retaliatory violence or the darkness of despair? Many of you are probably familiar with E.F. Schumacher. I would imagine that if you're not so familiar with him, you might at least have heard of his seminal and now classic work, Small is Beautiful. E.F. Schumacher wrote it in the early 70s. Schumacher was an economist and a theorist for England, and he wrote the book Small is Beautiful and subtitled A Buddhist Economics. Well, it was 7 years or so later, almost a decade, I guess, later, that Schumacher wrote another, much smaller volume, actually, a very thin volume, but what he said was the philosophical underpinnings of his earlier book, Small is Beautiful. And I've always been struck by the story that he begins with. He shares a personal story about when he had visited the Soviet Union. And he was on a visit to Leningrad, he says, at that point called Leningrad, some years ago. Schumacher writes, "I consulted a map to find out where I was, but I could not make it out. I could see several enormous churches, yet there was no trace of any of them on my map." When finally an interpreter came to help me, he said, "We don't show churches on our map." Contradicting him, I pointed to one that was very clearly marked. "This is a museum," he said, "not what we call a living church. It is only the living churches we don't show." Schumacher goes on to say, "It then occurred to him in that moment that this was not the first time I had been given a map that failed to show many of the things I could see right in front of my eyes. All through school and university, I had been given maps of life and knowledge on which there was hardly a trace of many of the things that I most cared about and that seemed to me to be of the greatest possible importance for the conduct of my life. I remembered that for many years my perplexity was complete, and no interpreter came along to help me. It remained complete until I ceased to suspect the sanity of my perceptions and began instead to suspect the soundness of the maps." Schumacher goes on in that small volume to outline the dire need to develop our attention and our inward awareness. He suggests that inner knowledge, or insight, as the sages of the East might say, is critical in developing a healthy, a whole, and indeed an integrated life. Adventure, wrote the author George Eliot, is not outside man, it is within. So for Schumacher, the world's religious traditions have provided guidance and wisdom for this inward adventure and journey. This is precisely the other intelligence that Rumi spoke of in the poem we read earlier. This other intelligence, Rumi writes, does not turn yellow or stagnate. It's fluid, and it doesn't move from outside to inside through conduits of plumbing learning. This second knowing is a fountainhead from within you, moving out. I was thinking that just as we might affirm the physical, biological truth that in some significant sense we are what we eat, so too genuine spiritual growth is a function of the education and understanding, we might say the care and feeding of the soul. So I want to talk some this morning about this mysterious and powerful relationship between the spiritual, or what I might call soul, development, and the deep capacity for loving acceptance of ourselves, others, and the power and the wherewithal to do justice and act with compassion out in our world. The saints and sages throughout time seem to be calling us ever back to our own deepest selves. Aldous Huxley, in his spiritual and philosophical classic, called this the perennial philosophy. So if we cultivate and grow as best we can this innermost self with attention, it will and does lead to dynamic clarity and acceptance of the universe, ourselves, and others, and offers the ground, a place to stand, the fulcrum from which to move to vital action in our world. I've been acquainted for many, many years now with a person by the name of Father Richard Rohr. Maybe some of you know Father Richard. He is a Franciscan friar. And actually, my acquaintance with Father Richard goes back, 40 years, 35 years ago now, and I still have a picture, a vivid one, of standing with Father Richard, actually kneeling, in the Capitol Rotunda of Washington, D.C., as we prayed together and then were subsequently arrested for committing nonviolent civil disobedience together as we stepped out and knelt against the nuclear weapons that were being built at that time through the nuclear freeze movement. You may recall that. So Father Richard was there, and I can remember this image. Well, it's only been then many years later. He went on to go to New Mexico in Albuquerque and begin a center called the Center for Action and Contemplation. And I've been graced with the opportunity to do a study practice program with Richard and many other teachers and seekers in these past couple years at the Center for Action and Contemplation called the Living School. He wrote a book. He's a prolific author. He wrote a book. It was entitled A Lever and a Place to Stand, The Contemplative Stance, The Active Prayer. He begins the first chapter with a quote from the Greek mathematician Archimedes. And Archimedes said this: "Give me a lever and a place to stand, and I will move the world." Rohr goes on to write in that chapter thereafter, "The fixed point is our place to stand. It is a contemplative stance, steady, centered, poised, and rooted. To be contemplative, we have to have a slight distance from the world. We have to allow time for withdrawal from business as usual, for meditation, for prayer in what Jesus calls our private room. However, in order for this not to be escapism, we have to remain quite close to the world at the same time, loving it, feeling its pains and joys as our pains and our joys. So the fulcrum must be somehow in the real world. True contemplation," Father Rohr goes on to say, "all the great masters also say, is really quite down to earth and practical and does not require life in a monastery. It is just an utterly different way of receiving the moment from all life and from everywhere. However, in order to have the capacity to move the world, we ironically need some distancing and detachment from the diversionary nature of mass culture, useless distractions, and the daily delusions of the false self." So the ancients, I would say, knew this intuitively. What we in our modern and outward material-obsessed culture seemed to have forgotten, that what resides within us is what can make us whole. The Greeks understood and talked about the threefold dimension of our existence: mind, body, and soul, or spirit. These three are constituents of our very nature. Socrates, the first and the greatest of the Greek philosophers, invited his students, as you know, he said, to know thyself. Indeed, he understood his work to be that of, he said, a midwife of the soul. He would say, those who know or understand the right will do the right. I think Socrates, we could say, and this was part of what was known now as the Axial Age, that is when great minds were thinking alike at great distances from one another, but he intuited what many of the ancients seemed to have known and thought, including the Buddha, who was teaching roughly around the same time as Socrates. The Buddha said, right understanding will lead to right action. So contemplation and action, we might say, are intricately intertwined. They are part of what can be imagined as the tapestry of the spiritual life. Like the warp and woof, both directions are needed for the weave. I've always been struck by the power and the challenge of the great prophetic voices in the Hebrew scriptures. Both the prophet Amos, of which our own Providence Amos House is named after, and the prophet Micah seem to be calling the people to turn their attention from the external physical rites and rituals that their lives had become so caught up in, and redirect it to the inner power of God's Spirit, to genuine relationship with the divine. And it was precisely this relationship that would then embolden them and propel them to dynamic action for peace and love and justice in the world. And I've been struck by particularly the book of Micah for some time and chewing on the words of this prophet. We actually, for many of you who know us personally, named our oldest daughter Micah after the male prophet. We used to actually affectionately call our daughter Micah, Micah 6:8, occasionally, which came from the famous verse, of course, some of you might know. It's a compelling verse. Amos says, what, O mortal, does God, the divine, the ground of being, require of us but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? This verse, this call, seems to have the energy of simultaneity. Just do this. Do these three things. Do them now. The prophet Micah has indeed created the weave for us, the warp and the woof. Let go of the extraneous and be about knowing yourself, the God within. That is, walk humbly. Accepting yourself, the universe, and others, love, kindness, and mercy. And act for what is good and right in the world. Do justice. So my simple message this morning is really no more than an invitation and hopefully an encouragement to cultivate, to continue to cultivate, to begin to cultivate and grow your inner awareness, your contemplative stance. I am convinced that we need more and more what might be termed an engaged spirituality. It is the Buddhist master, many of you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, who I think coined the notion of engaged Buddhism. Our activism and social political engagement needs to be spiritually, contemplatively grounded. And our spirituality needs to be worldly wise and engaged. Richard Rohr talks about what he terms an incarnational mysticism. We need to embody genuine action in the world that grows out of the contemplative stance. But this, even as I'm sharing it with you, is not easy. I can feel it. I guess it's why the world's religious traditions and philosophical paths have called it practice. I'm mindful, actually, this month I was told that the first Unitarians' themes for the month of October are courage and death. And I was invited, if I could, to weave them in, but it seemed to be hand in glove. Here, courage and death. Such a life that seeks to develop a spiritual and contemplative stance in this world of nonstop activity and busyness takes a certain courage, which in turn involves, does it not, a kind of dying to one's frenetic activity, one's ego, one's false self. You know, I'm heartened when I'm reminded of something that a teacher of mine in graduate theological school told me many years ago. It hit me kind of like a mind bomb. When reflecting on the life and teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, the rhetorical question he asked was, what was more important, that Jesus acted and taught and compassionately healed in the streets, or that he drew himself apart in solitude to pray? For the scriptures, by the way, are clear that Jesus quite regularly and intentionally separated himself from the crowds and even his closest disciples to go into the mountains and pray. My teacher went on to say that certainly Jesus could not have done the work that he did in the streets unless he had drawn himself apart to the mountains to contemplate. Such was the Tao of Jesus, who modeled the wisdom, embodied the wisdom of the great Taoist sages, and picked up on something of a story that I want to share from one of the Taoist masters and storytellers by the name of Chuang Tzu. It's called The Poem of the Woodcarver, and seems to speak to this essence. The poem goes like this: King, the master carver, made a bell stand of precious wood. When it was finished, all who saw it were astounded. They said it must be the work of spirits. The Prince of Lei said to the master carver, "What is your secret?" King replied, "I am only a workman. I have no secret. There is only this. When I began to think about the work you commanded, I guarded my spirit and did not expend it on trifles that were not to the point. I fasted in order to set my heart at rest. After 3 days fasting, I had forgotten praise or criticism. After 7 days, I had forgotten my body with all its limbs. By this time, all thought of your highness and of the court had faded away. All that might distract me from the work had vanished. I was collected in the single thought of the bell stand. Then I went to the forest to see the trees in their own natural state. When the right tree appeared before my eyes, the bell stand also appeared in it. Clearly, beyond doubt, all I had to do was to put forth my hand and begin. If I had not met this particular tree, there would have been no bell stand at all. What happened? My own collected thoughts encountered the hidden potential in the wood. From this live encounter came the work, which you ascribe to the spirits. So might we, too, have the courage and the grace to recollect ourselves, to tap into this inner intelligence, to trust with E.F. Schumacher the sanity of your deepest perceptions, and to cultivate a genuinely contemplative stance and the stillness from which to dance in activity and really, really move our world that is in such need. I close with lines of a poem that you may know from T.S. Eliot that seems appropriate. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope. For hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness the dancing. Amen.